The Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is 1:40 in the afternoon of Wednesday, March the 12th, 2008. We have a quorum to conduct business. We have Senator McGuire here, Senator Terrio, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. We have two bills I'd like to bring up and potentially move out of committee today, and then we'll get to the calendar that's listed. But the first one is HB 165, the bill we heard from Representative Ledoux regarding big game hunters and field accommodations. We listened to a presentation about the bill on Monday, heard public testimony, had some debate in the committee. I just wanted to kind of let the bill rest for a couple days to make certain there were no lingering issues. I think this is the last committee of referral. Are there any other committee questions or concerns about the bill as we have it here before us today? Hearing and seeing none, I would solicit a motion.
Mr. Chair, with regard to HB 165, I would move that we pass this bill out of committee with individual recommendations and I believe it's a zero fiscal note. Any attached fiscal notes?
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved from committee. Next up is SB 164. A little closer. SB 164, brought to us by Senator McGuire, and I believe she has a CS for us to take a look at. Senator McGuire.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, backslash E, and Trevor, you want to?
Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record.
Motion to.
That's the way I think we should have it in front of us and then discuss
yeah,
it.
Okay.
Different people do it different ways.
So, Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt backslash E version, the CS for Senate Bill number 164 for purposes of discussion.
And I'll object just to make it clear that it's. I'll object. It's in front of us now. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Trevor Fulton. I'm staff for Senator Lisa McGuire. I assume you want me to take this opportunity to explain the changes between the original bill and the committee substitute we have before us now, version E.
Please.
Okay. Essentially, between the time when you last heard Senate Bill 164 and now, there was concern brought up that maybe this bill, or as how this bill would affect current litigation out there involving disclosures on used motor vehicle sales. What this committee substitute does is we hope address that concern in that it changes the retroactive application of the bill and protects current litigation or excludes current litigation from that retroactivity.
That was the way I read the new provisions on lines 11 through 14 on page 1 and line 1 of page 2. Questions or comments about the retroactivity? The idea, I understand, is just to allow any pending case to continue to its conclusion without affecting the rights of the individuals that are now in court, but to preclude any future court action.
And that is exactly our intent, Mr. Chairman.
Senator McGuire, any other comment on that?
No, Mr. Chairman, just on the record, it was not our intent, I want to be clear, in the original bill to capture any existing litigation or any rights that any Alaskan might have, but we want to make it very clear, and so that's what the language does.
Very good. We have had a hearing on this bill. And let me just ask maybe you, Senator McGuire, have you had any opposition to this bill? Have you heard from individuals from, Ed Sniffen, the consumer advocate, is in favor of the bill? Have you heard from ACPERG or any other, you know, consumer advocacy group that's opposed to the bill?
No, Mr. Chairman, and you might recall or not, but I supported the underlying concept that the law actually addressed, and it was a consumer rights piece of legislation. However, we went too far, overreached, and that's, we've been working with Ed Sniffen on that. I've had no opposition.
Further committee discussion or debate? The public testimony is closed. The bill is before us. Is there a motion?
I'm going to move it. Mr. Chairman, I move that we move CS for Senate Bill number 164 with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note out of the Judiciary Committee.
Is there objection? Hearing none, the bill is moved out of committee. Let's take a 2-minute at ease while we get all our paperwork squared away. SB 264, an act relating to partial birth abortion. We have the prime sponsor here, Senator Olson, if you come forward. And let me just say, as we begin, this is always a difficult subject to talk about and debate and discuss. There are strong feelings on both sides of this issue. I know we've got folks signed up to testify and folks here to testify. We invite all that testimony. We welcome it. It's crucial to our system of democracy that we debate these things out in public. Nevertheless, I will expect that everyone will comport themselves in a way that's respectful to each side. I know everyone has strong opinions. I know I'm going to give everybody an opportunity to speak as passionately as they like, but with respect to folks of differing points of view. And with that, Senator Olson, I'll turn it over to you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is, for the record, my name is Donald Olson. I'm the state senator from District T, which is northern and western Alaska. And this afternoon, I present to you Senate Bill 264, which is an act relating to partial birth abortions. I echo the same sentiments that you do, Mr. Chairman. This is an emotional issue. Many people feel very strongly about it. Obviously, there are differences of opinion that need to be looked at. But I think overall, we need to understand that we as human beings are all here to go ahead and respect each other as God-given people that are able to go ahead and look at something and try and decide on something on an issue that is commensurate with the type of society we want to live in. Senate Bill 264 was put forth by me since the U.S. Supreme Court determined that states, not the federal government, should control certain medical procedures within their state boundaries. Abortions have been legal in Alaska for some time. Despite strong controversy on the abortion issue, there's one practice that many people agree should be looked at, and even pro-life people or pro-choice people do not agree with the partial birth abortion issue or procedure. The partial birth abortion or late-term abortion is a process that has been controversial, and this bill goes ahead and addresses it. And what it does essentially, Mr. Chairman, it puts Alaska statute in line with the federal language that came out of Congress. Senate Bill 264 is a bill that goes ahead and describes or puts into statute the definition of what a partial birth abortion is, and discusses the overt action that is there. And that's essentially what it does. And with that, I bring to you this bill with hopefully ask for your support with it. And I've got a number of people online that can answer questions from the drafters of the legislation as well as the reviser to it. And so with that, I open for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Olson? Let me just ask one, Senator. I think, you know, you, of all the members of the legislature, certainly are probably uniquely positioned to speak about this bill, given your background in medicine and your background in law. And one of the things that came to me as I was reading the Gonzalez decision last night was the discussion about the health of the mother exception that's frequently been added to many abortion bans, was not added to this one. And I guess I don't know. Let me just ask you, what's your view of the sort of degree of medical uncertainty with respect to whether an intact D&E is less risky to the health of a female as compared to a standard D&E?
Let's see. You'll have to define D&E for me, I guess. You're not talking about a D&C, are you?
Maybe I wrote it down wrong. Yep, yeah, D&C. I'm very sorry. I'm very sorry. D&C, yes.
The dilatation and curettage is a procedure that's normally done by medical practice people, physicians in particular, and other healthcare providers to go ahead and essentially dilate the cervix and go in with the instrument and go ahead and evacuate what's inside the uterus. And so that's the shortened version of what a D&C is. And if you could go ahead and ask your specific question again in relation to the Carhartt. You're talking about the Carhartt case, correct?
Sure. And I'm reading from the Supreme Court decision in the Gonzalez decision. and I'm getting up close to the microphone because I understand folks can't hear me. And in that decision, they give a fairly lengthy description of what they call a D and E. And I wish I could give you the page number, but I can't. But in the Senator Wilkowski
defines it, page 4, dilation and evacuation.
Dilation and evacuation.
Okay.
And in the Gonzales decision, they point out that there are sort of two ways of performing a D and E. One is the standard method, and one is the intact method. The intact method is the method that's being discussed by your bill, and the standard method is different and involves several passes, if you will, by a set of forceps into a woman's uterus to remove the fetus. You know, I can't say it in any way except in pieces.
Sure.
And yet those several passes, some medical experts feel create a greater risk of abrasion, cuts, infection, and so forth than the intact D&E, which do not. And so it strikes me that probably one of the biggest questions is whether this bill of yours, this proposal of yours, truly, since the health of the mother is one of the things that we've been consistently told by the Supreme Court over the years that we have to consider when we look at an abortion ban, whether this bill shouldn't contain a health of the mother exception, given that the standard D&E requires those passes, which seem to imply a greater degree of medical risk.
Well, first of all, let me clear it up that just because you've been to school doesn't mean you're a practitioner. I went to medical school and I'm a physician, and I can speak from that standpoint. I've been to law school, but I'm not a lawyer, just so you have that as the backdrop so that nobody gets the wrong idea as to what's going on. But as far as what your decision, what you're talking about is certainly in the health of a mother. When you have a mother that comes on in with a number of children and she's starting to bleed out, as has been the case in some of the situations that I've seen, that you've got, and as her hematocrit starts to run low, you need to do something in order to save that mother. And whatever means are necessary to go ahead and evacuate or stop the bleeding is what I consider the standard of medical care out there. And then that's the obligation that I think a practitioner has to the patient that comes through the doors of whatever institution you happen to be working at, whether it's a private clinic or a hospital. As far as going out and taking out a late-term conceptus that's there that may or may not be viable, I think that's where people start to go ahead and raise questions as to whether that is should be allowed. And I think that's where the emotional argument comes in at that point. You certainly are correct in that if you're dealing with a dilatation, first of all, the dilatation of the cervix is one of those things that's fairly uncomfortable, especially if it's done without anesthesia or any kind of analgesic type of medication. The dilatation is obviously I've never experienced it, but it looks fairly uncomfortable when I've been doing it. And then you go in there and with a curette or the curettage, or in your case, where you brought up the idea of using a pair of forceps, that there is indeed, you're introducing a foreign object into the cavity of a human being. And whenever you do anything like that, you're at risk for abrasions, you're at risk for infections, you're at risk for a number of other things. One of the things that I have seen most often, though, has actually been perforation of the uterus, and I think that's one of the things is very difficult to evaluate. I know there have been a fair number of complications with that in the practice when I was practicing full time, and we want to try and avoid that at all cost. And but as far as evacuating something that's intact, I think that you're still dealing with the idea that you're tearing off from the, and I'm not sure how picturesque you want me to get it, but you're essentially abrading the placenta away from the lining of the uterus. Obviously, there's going to be some bleeding with that, and there's other medical risks that you may be putting the mother's life at more danger than she was if she was actually to go ahead and continue on with the pregnancy. And let me make it clear that pregnancy in itself is a risk itself. In itself, it has its own medical risks, because there are people that many women before the practice of medicine became more complicated and more developed than it here is in the Western society. And you can see this in third world countries. People that are pregnant many times do die in pregnancy given childbirth.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Other questions for Senator Olson while he's here? We do have a lot of folks signed up to testify.
Chairman,
Senator Terrio.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Is there particular words or phrases here in the new suggested language that you think specifically will meet the requirement of the court to have this survive the state constitutional challenge that I would expect would be coming?
When you talk about, through the chair, Senator Terrio, when you talk about the court, are you talking about the Alaska Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme, what court are you talking about?
The Alaska Supreme Court.
Or are you talking about just a Superior Court district?
Any
the first, the first court of review.
First or second. But is there something in the previous court deliberation that caused the drafter, you and the drafter, to include particular word structure here?
As you look at the draft of the legislation, I guess what I have to do is we should have somebody from the drafter's office online, or the reviser, Pam Finley, that should be online to go ahead and answer that specific question.
I think we have Catherine Kurtz from Legal Services who's on the line. Ms. Kurtz, can you hear my voice?
Hi, this is Catherine Kurtz. I'm an assistant reviser with Legal Services. And I can tell you that I expect Jean Michel, who's the drafter of this bill, to be online shortly.
If we could
okay.
Hold,
Mr. Are we still waiting for Mr. Michel to understand? He was... Kurt, I'm sorry, Kurt Michel.
Jean Michel.
I'm sorry, yep. Ms. Michel to appear. She's late getting to committee or late getting to the office?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just apologize, she has been out of town and is, I think I told you before, that she's been out of town and was going to hurry to the office or hurry to get to a phone where she might be able to answer some specific questions as was addressed to me by Senator Terrio.
Why don't we go ahead and hold that question then, and let's turn to public testimony. I know there are folks who want to testify, and we have one person who I know is under a time crunch themselves. And so with your indulgence, Senator Olson, I'm going to go ahead and do that, turn to the public testimony and begin to listen to some of the folks I know that want to testify about the bill. And first up, I have Dr. Whitefield. Dr. Whitefield, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
And if you would go ahead and state your name and your affiliation, we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
My name is Dr. Jan Whitefield. I'm an obstetrician-gynecologist who practices in Anchorage. And I actually am a person who does pregnancy terminations, and I object to this bill. As you and your honored colleagues have spoken, you have used the term late-term abortion and the term D&E. Now, the bill that I have in front of me, the Senate Bill 264, describes what a, quote, partial birth abortion means, and it goes through an actual description. And if one puts on the hat of a person who thinks of a, quote, D&E or partial birth abortion, each of you will have an image in your mind as to what that means, what it means to bring a fetus through a mother's vagina, to where the fetus dies, acts that may be performed. And you would have some sort of an image of that. Now, as a person who practices both first and second trimester abortions, I have to look at this legislation and think about this generally in terms of the description and then specifically what it means to me as a practitioner. And in addition, I took this bill to my colleagues. I have, of course, five other colleagues who perform abortions in my office. And we all went through the bill. And there's nothing in this bill that talks about how far along in pregnancy would be before this bill would be applied. This doesn't say this is a second trimester definition. This doesn't say it's a late second trimester definition. In fact, the definition of where in pregnancy that this would be applied is completely void. It's not stated whatsoever. When I do a first trimester pregnancy termination, one of the things that I will do is dilate the cervix and put a vacuum suction tube through the cervix into the uterus. at the time that I do that, if a woman has had a number of children, her cervix may actually lie at the opening of her vagina. And when I apply the suction to empty the patient's uterus out at a 12-week pregnancy or an 11-week pregnancy, sometimes I will see the feet of the fetus come up the suction tube when the abortion is being done. And when the fetus entered the suction tube, it was alive. And when it comes out at the end of the suction tube, obviously it's not alive. The problem is that in this particular law which is being proposed, it doesn't exclude that particular act as being included under the definition of a partial birth abortion. In this particular case, what would be done is I would be bringing the fetus into a suction tube, and I would see, in this case, if the feet are coming out first, it would be a breech presentation. And the fetus may be essentially almost completely outside the woman's body before it actually dies. And that's, of course, limited to women who have a lot of relaxation of the vagina and cervix, and the cervix is present at the opening of the vagina. So this bill has unintended consequences. The way it's written, if I do the standard vacuum suction first trimester pregnancy termination, it would be entirely possible for somebody to look over my shoulders and say, look, I see that fetus's feet in the fallopian tube, and it was dead when it came out the tube, but it was alive when it went into the tube, and that is therefore a partial birth abortion. As I see it, the way this law is written, there's unintended consequences. And the penalty is not malpractice. The penalty is 2 years in prison, if you look at the federal bill, along with considerable monetary problems. When I took this bill and showed it to my partners who do first trimester pregnancy terminations and said, as you read this bill, would this modify your practice in terms of what you would offer a patient in terms of a first trimester pregnancy termination, 3 of the 5 said yes, that they would limit how far along in the first trimester they would go because they were concerned that the ambiguity in the way the bill was written could therefore be applied to a first trimester termination. And as such, I see that as unintended consequences of the way this was written. And maybe I'm fooling myself. Maybe those were intended consequences. Maybe it was meant to be chilling to people who do pregnancy terminations at any point in pregnancy. Anyway, that's what I had to say, and I apologize for taking more time than I was allotted.
Mr. Whitefield, Dr. Whitefield, I'm looking around the committee to see if there were any questions for you. At the moment, I do not see any. Thank you for making yourself available this afternoon.
Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Senator Olson, do you have folks that you'd like to have testify?
No, I don't.
I'll work off the list, and I just want to make sure. I'm sorry?
Michelle just came on.
Okay. Jean Michelle, I understand you're on the line?
Yes, I am.
Ms. Michelle, there was a question earlier, and maybe Senator Terry can just rephrase it now that you're on the line and we can get an answer. Thanks.
Yes, I'm just wondering, from the litigation that took place on the current wording in the statutes and the suggested wording that you've got in Senate Bill 264, are there any particular phrases that, you know, things are worded a particular way because that's the way it appears the court, that it'll be meaningful or make a difference to the court?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, yes. The bill changes the phrasing fairly significantly from a legal standpoint in the definition of partial birth abortion. And it tracks precisely the congressional act that was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. And the phrases that were significant in the recent decision was the phrase on page, let's see, page 2, wait a second, let me back up. The Okay, deliberately and intentionally is it was significant in that case. That's page one, line six, so that it couldn't apply to an inadvertent partial birth abortion if a physician were intending to perform a regular DNC or DNE or whatever the phrase is. And the fetus came out a little too far. If it weren't deliberate and intentional, then there would be no violation under this act. Also, page 1, line 8, is existing language, but it's modified. Delivers a living fetus for the purpose of performing an overt act that the person knows will kill the fetus. the phrase living fetus was significant in the analysis under the Congressional Act. There was some concern that the delivery might occur after the death of the fetus and still be considered a partial birth or a prohibited partial birth abortion. And the phrase overt act was also very significant in the court's analysis. So again, that it's not a miscarriage or something that would have killed the fetus other than a certain type of abortion. What is not in this bill is any limitation on the trimester that this procedure is performed. The Congressional Act applies expressly to during or after second trimester of the pregnancy. This bill arguably could apply in the first trimester. We didn't modify the prohibition in existing law. This is just a definitional change to track the congressional standards that were upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. So Dr. Whitefield is correct that there could be, there is the potential for enforcement without any change to the bill for a first trimester partial birth abortion, since that's not specified anywhere in state law currently. I hope I answered your question.
Thank you. As people express concern about a possible interpretation, I just wanted to have in mind what key phrases, because certainly key phrases are important or were meaningful to the court.
Yes, and I'm sorry I didn't finish that answer, Senator Terrio, if I may, through the chair. The other very significant change in SB 264 that also mirrors the Congressional Act is the description of how far the fetus comes through the mother's vagina. The past, it was unclear, at least in other state laws, it had been found to be unconstitutional. So what the U.S. Supreme Court did is go into some detail about why this is not too ambiguous to enforce or for a physician to understand, and it gave anatomical landmarks, which the court stated clearly distinguished that from a regular abortion, or for lack of a better word. There was some testimony in the U.S. Supreme Court case or some evidence that physicians might be wrongfully prosecuted for performing an abortion that wasn't a partial birth abortion because the lines are pretty fuzzy when you're delivering a tiny little fetus or parts of a fetus. And if you read the case, the U.S. Supreme Court goes into graphic detail about why this definition is doesn't suffer for constitutional vagueness, because it's got anatomical landmarks that provide some clarity.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Ms. Michelle, if you could just, well, first of all, the intent of this bill is not to go ahead and ban abortions. I just want to make that very clear to the committee. And it's, we've already got U.S. Supreme Court on Roe v. Wade that does that, as well as other issues. And so that's not the intent of this bill here. But there are the possibility of unintended consequences that was brought up by Dr. Whitefield. And I guess I would like you to address those to make sure that from a legal standpoint, you answer the questions in a way that allays the common practitioner that's out there, the obstetrician or other healthcare provider that might be looking at some of the unintended consequences and are very concerned about them for good reason. If you would, please.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, what I just discussed and what this bill addresses is the federal analysis of the constitutionality of a partial birth abortion ban. And this is consistent, other than the setting of the trimesters, with the Congressional Act. But we have in our state constitution an express right to privacy, and I can't state with any certainty that our state Supreme Court would agree with the U.S. Supreme Court that this isn't constitutionally vague or doesn't otherwise infringe on an Alaska resident's right to privacy. But I can really only speak to what we have heard from the Alaska Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court relied heavily on a case called Casey, C-A-S-E-Y. Our Alaska Supreme Court's already rejected Casey's interpretation of a woman's right to privacy in the context of an abortion. So there is some possibility that under our more protective state constitution that enforcement, I think the likelihood is that somebody will ask for a declaratory judgment so that we can hear from our Alaska State Supreme Court. But in terms of when these abortions are performed, since there is no limitation to second trimester, I agree with Dr. Whitefield that performing a partial birth abortion in the first trimester, if that's even physically possible, is arguably prohibited under this bill. The definition of partial birth abortion does provide, as I said, the anatomical landmarks so that physicians aren't prohibited from performing any other type of abortion under the bill. Just an abortion that is performed after partially delivering a living fetus through the vagina that causes the entire fetal head to come outside the mother's body, or the trunk past the navel if it's a breech delivery. I mean, that's about as specific as I can be in response to any real practice questions. But the intent of the bill and the function of the Congressional Act that was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court was to prescribe only the living fetus partial delivery type of abortion that has a more technical term, but we're all calling it a partial birth abortion. And I think these committee hearings are a good opportunity to for committee members to describe and to make clear that the intention of SB 264 is not to prohibit other types of legalized abortion in the state.
Well,
Senator McGuire.
Yeah, and with all due respect, I appreciate always your analysis, but I think what Senator Olson is saying, just narrowly confined, is that he would like to have the point in the trimester point defined in the bill, and so as to remove that concern. And so, with all due respect to the idea that someone would go back and review our tapes and what our intent is, I think it's probably better to have that clear, whether you like the bill or not, to have the trimester point clear in the language itself. And so I guess the question is, in other states that have put forward legislation based on the Gonzales and the federal legislation, have they defined second and third trimester in the bill, in the legislation?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, my limited review of other states' reaction to the Gonzales case is that, unlike Alaska, those states already had a trimester limit in their existing law. But I would...
Okay.
I think an educated guess is that most states do expressly limit the prohibition to second trimester abortions, as does the Congressional Act. But since our partial birth abortion prohibition and current law didn't have a trimester limit, and this bill just redefines the meaning of partial birth abortion, really to avoid the vagueness challenge, it is a good idea. And I agree with you that if the intent of the committee is to limit this to second trimester abortions, that should be included in this bill.
Thank you.
Further questions for Ms. Michelle? I don't see any. If you could stay on the line, though, I imagine we'd be turning to you from time to time for legal expertise. We have four other folks signed up to testify. Let's turn now to Anchorage, where we've got Clover Simon signed up to testify. Ms. Simon, are you on the line?
Yes. Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
You need to get a little closer to that microphone. You're a soft-spoken person, and you're a long way away.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Clover Simon. I'm the CEO for Planned Parenthood of Alaska, and I'm opposed to Senate Bill 264. The language in this bill closely tracks the federal ban, which was just discussed, that was upheld in 2007 by the U.S. Supreme Court. However, the Alaska Supreme Court has held that the state constitution's right to privacy is stronger than the federal right. And in March of 1998, the Alaska Superior Court found the newly enacted statute 18.16.050 partial birth abortion ban in violation of the Alaska Constitution. And I don't feel that this change in language adequately addresses why it was found unconstitutional. From the conclusion in the Superior Court, in quotes, the act is also found to be a restriction on a woman's fundamental right to an abortion as set forth in Valley Hospital by burdening virtually all abortion due to its vagueness, and therefore is unconstitutional for that reason as well. The act is a violation of a woman's right to privacy guaranteed by the Alaska Constitution. What continues to trouble me about this bill is that all procedures covered under the federal abortion ban passed in 2003, which was upheld by the federal Supreme Court, are already against the law nationwide and obviously here in Alaska. Currently, these procedures, as described in the bill, if they truly do apply to second trimester abortion, are not happening here. Secondly, the bill does not address the protection of the health of a woman who might, under some horrible circumstance, need medical care that might be construed as falling under this ban. The sponsor stated that this bill puts in definition in our state statutes some clarity to partial birth. However, there's still, as was just discussed, no clarity on when the statute goes into effect. So I am definitely opposed to this bill. If you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer them. Thank you.
Ms. Simon, I don't see any questions for you. Thank you for testifying. Next up, we have Robin Henry. Ms. Henry, are you on the line?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Please put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, if any, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Robin Henry. I'm a resident of Anchorage, Alaska, and I've lived here in Alaska for about the past 15 years. There's some confusion. I've had some confusion regarding the discussion that's been going on about this bill, but I'd like to address specifically from a personal level my the issue of addressing a woman's health risk. I hope you don't mind. I'll be reading from a prepared statement here. I'd like to start off by talking a little bit about my son, Marcus. In October of 2003, I'd learned that I was pregnant with Marcus. I had been trying to conceive for over 2 years, but nothing had prepared me for the emotions I'd experienced when I discovered I was carrying new life. It was my turn to experience the miracle. Each night, I'd read books about Marcus's development and marveled at the changes in my body. I could not have been more thrilled about having this child. Then, in January of 2004, approximately 19 weeks into my pregnancy, I'd gotten the result of a test that indicated possible Down syndrome. After only a moment's hesitation, I made a commitment to raise and love my son as he was unconditionally. A blood test was followed by an ultrasound in preparation for an amniocentesis, but the ultrasound revealed the condition to be much worse than Down's. Marcus had severe cystic hygroma with high drops, a disease that causes fluid under the skin and in the fetal cavity. In Marcus's case, the fluid buildup was extensive. The doctor explained to me that the condition was fatal. Given the extent of the continual fluid buildup, there was no chance that Marcus would survive. The only question now was how long he would live before dying in my womb. In addition, the doctor explained to me that the situation could lead to a condition called maternal mirror syndrome. In this situation, this is a situation where I could acquire a similar fatal condition to Marcus, which in my case could lead to adult respiratory distress and other complications. The situation left me with two choices. Number one, let the condition take its course, have a stillborn baby, and risk getting very seriously ill myself. Or two, safely discontinue the pregnancy of my dying son. While it was not an easy choice to accept, it was rather straightforward. I chose to preserve my own life. As you listen to my personal story, I bring to you this challenge. Imagine yourself in my shoes, or imagine yourself in my doctor's shoes. What would it be like to be told after hearing such devastating news that I would be forced to wait for my child to die, deliver a stillborn baby, and in the process accept the possibility of becoming fatally ill? That I would not have access to an existing safe procedure that would preserve my own health. Put yourself in those shoes, because those are my shoes, and I am the face and the name of a mother that would be affected by this bill if you don't include health for the mother in this bill. In closing my statement, I would like to say that I agree with those of you that believe this bill is about life, and I agree with those of you who believe this bill is about choice. But it's not about life versus choice, but it's about choosing existing life, which is what I did in honor and memory of my dying son. So I would ask that you, from what I'm hearing from you in this discussion, I want my story to bring home the idea that you need to be very clear about the language in the bill and understand the situations like I was in exist out there, and that, and they're very difficult, and restricting options can be heartbreaking. Thank you very much.
Ms. Henry, thank you for your testimony. I don't see any questions from members of the committee. Next up is Donna Stark. Ms. Stark, are you on the line?
Yes, I am, Chairman.
Please put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, if any. We'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Yes, my name is Donna Stark, and I am a resident of Anchorage, and I am here to represent myself today on this issue. I am here to express my opposition to SB 264. I still find it hard to fathom that the U.S. Congress passed, the United States President signed, and the United States Supreme Court upheld a law that, in effect, imposes the death penalty on certain women in this country. To pass a law interfering with a woman's right to self-determination concerning her medical care was bad enough, but to not leave any provision for exceptions for her health, in essence, sentences certain women to death. I would urge you now to reconsider the federal law as an unlawful imposition of the death sentence in our state. I especially hope you would not repeat the mistake by duplicating that law at the state level. Just recently, our state legislature had firsthand experience with unintended consequences of laws passed for political expediency. In the rush to show the public that it cared about ethics after the corruption scandal, the legislature finally took action to limit campaign contributions and gifts. What we all found was that these new limits would interfere with one of your members' ability to receive a life-saving organ transplant. Who knew when the law was first crafted that this situation would arise? Fortunately, when the consequences of your actions were discovered, you voted reasonably to make an exception that would allow your fellow legislators to take the medical steps necessary to save his life. It's very easy to ignore unintended consequences when there is no personal example and the people affected are invisible. Rather than some unknown woman, let me use the recently revealed pregnancy of Governor Palin as an example. If you don't already know, pregnancy later in a woman's life carries more risks of complications. What if Governor Palin were faced with some unforeseen crisis during the latter months of her pregnancy? Who of you here would have the right to decide that her doctors could not save her life? Would you really limit her physician's options because you want to score political points in the abortion debate? I also refer back to the corruption scandal. I'm fairly certain that all of the indicted legislatures, the indicted chiefs of staff, and those still facing charges campaigned for their office on an anti-abortion platform. I do not believe I would entrust my medical care to any of them or any of the ones who may yet be indicted. Before this current session started, I attended a constituent town hall meeting. I heard testimony about low-income health clinics closing, about unaffordable daycare costs, unaffordable health care costs, the plights of parents with incarcerated children, in essence, a very long list of human needs. Do we really need to spend our valuable court and police resources arresting doctors for trying to save their patients' lives? Do we have room in jail for them? I was fairly certain we have a shortage of doctors in this state. Please let the federal government spend their resources on enforcement of this thoughtless law. In conclusion, just a couple of days ago, Governor Palin made the comment that if anyone thought she couldn't handle being governor and have a baby, why, that was the thinking of a Neanderthal. I could not agree with her more. Women have had a long, hard fight, and we have proven over and over that we are more than capable of determining our own destinies. This legislation is the exact antithesis of a woman's rights. It is an exact example of Neanderthal thinking. Thank you.
Ms. Stark, thank you. I don't see any questions for you. Next up is Eileen Becker, who's on the line from Homer. Ms. Becker, can you hear my voice?
Yes, I can. Karen. Can you hear me fine?
Yes, we can. Go ahead and put yourself on the record. State your affiliation, if any. We'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Yeah, thank you very much. I am Eileen Becker. And besides being a wife and mother and a business owner, I'm also the director of the Pregnancy Care Center here in Homer. I've served in that position for 11 years, and I've been really involved in the abortion issue. I think one of the things that I, in listening to a lot of these testimonies, of course, my mind's just going whirling, but one of the things that I think that this bill will do in a positive way, it will seal up a lot of the loopholes that was created by Roe versus Wade. In studying that bill, when it was passed in 1973, 35 years ago, there were just really no parameters that were put on the bill as far as who could perform the abortions, who could do it, at what age, viability of the fetus. None of this was really even an issue at that time. And so I think a lot of the bills and the issues that have been brought up over the years have been kind of doing a housekeeping and getting things in a lot better order. And one of the things, technology has advanced so much over the years to realize what actually happens in the womb. Women were told to believe at 3 months or so that it was just a blob, and you basically were scraping out, just an excess of things that were there. And we know now, primarily, the partial birth abortion is done at the 5th month, about halfway through the pregnancy. The baby's in a waking and sleeping pattern. He feels pain. The heart had started beating at 21 days. They know, too, that the baby's in a dream situation because there's rapid eye movement. The marrow has turned to bone. Strong kicks, aware of outside noises. 5-month-old babies in the womb can live outside the womb. They are a viable entity. And I think all of this, we're not really considering this baby. I guess personally, myself, the part of the bill that says that they would determine the, have a benchmark, the ultrasounds are so common. You can tell pretty much by any ultrasound how far along the fetus has developed, how long the gestation period has been. This bill closes in a gap. It makes the baby important. It brings value to that life. With a partial birth abortion, the baby's turned around, taken out feet first. A sharp object is run into its neck. The brains are sucked out, and then the rest of the baby is delivered. And it's a grisly practice that, as an American and as a human being, I find extremely, extremely disturbing. So we as Alaska need to take a stand for this kind of a life, get in step with the things that nationwide, statistically, people are very much against this type of an abortion. We need to become part of that. Any questions, I'd be glad to answer it. Maybe I'm here just to speak up for the little ones because I know that they can live outside the womb, and I also know that there's a lot of people that would love to have these babies.
Ms. Becker, thank you for your testimony. I don't see any questions. Senator Olson, we've heard lots of public testimony. Would you like to respond to any of it?
Well, first of all, as was pointed out, maybe I should clear up that the intent of this bill is to go ahead and make to mirror the federal language that is already out there that has been brought up forth by the U.S. Supreme Court, signed into law by the president after it went through the Congress. 36 states have already regulating the procedures that are done within their borders. Alaska is one of the minority of states that does not do that. Now, one of the things I do want to clear up that was pointed out by Ms. Simon that, and to make sure it's clear to the committee, that Alaska Statute 1816.050 still is there. Paragraphs A and B are unaffected, and all this does is modify paragraph C, so you have the protection to save the life of a mother that's under under paragraph A, and I hope that clears up some of the people's questions as to whether the life of the mother is called in here. And I think those are the only questions that I can answer right now of what I've heard from the testimony so far, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Is there anyone else? I probably should have asked, is there anyone else online or here in the room that wants to testify on SB 264? Looks like the answer is no. With that, let's go ahead and close public testimony, set the bill aside, and we'll move on to the next bill. Thank you, Senator Olson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Next up is SB 268, brought to us by Representative Bill Stoltz from the House of Representatives or his loyal staff. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir.
Please put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, if any, and we'd be happy to hear a presentation on the bill.
Thank you, sir. For the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, staff to Representative Bill Stoltz. I have to apologize for the representative. We had two pieces of legislation at the same time, and he is covering the other one.
We know which one he thinks is most important.
He trusts me fully, sir.
Please proceed.
What House Bill 268 will do is create a felony for an individual who intentionally starts a fire or causes an explosion in which damages a motor vehicle. This is a piece of legislation that came from one of our communities where, on average, you can up to a dozen vehicles. This happens to a dozen vehicles.
In what sort of time frame?
A year.
A year.
Annually.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Senator
Wilikowski has a question.
Would that be Jim Creek?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
Very good. Now we know what part of the state we're talking about.
I've seen several of them.
Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, just for a note, when we were in House Judiciary, we heard from the other committee members and some people from around the state, and it happens, surprisingly enough, it's just not our small corner of Alaska that this happens to, which is good to hear because at least we're not that way special.
I think it happens in Spinard from time to time, but as I say, keep going.
This came from members of our community. We had it drafted and vetted through public safety and the Department of Law and our community, and we brought it forward through the process. If there's any questions.
Let me see. Is there any differentiation between a nice, bright, shiny new car and a junker that's out in the woods with respect to your bill? Are each of those items treated the same?
Yes, sir, they are treated the same. They create the same hazard when someone either, starts that vehicle on fire, or someone who happened to have a new car and it happens to them. The dangers are still the same.
And how frequently, for example, in my community, Kincaid Park is a place where old cars used to be pushed off the bluff. And then they'd throw some dirt over the top of them and just left them there to rot. They've removed a lot of them, but not all of them have been removed. And people do take cars out there and torch them. I've jogged and skied past or biked past a car that was out in Kincaid for about a week that had been basically burned to the ground by a fire. So it happens not only in Spinard, but also in South Anchorage. I guess I'm kind of wondering, and maybe this is a question more for Trooper Dial or someone at Ledge Legal, but how much of a car you have to have or how much of a car you have to burn before this statute would come into play? If you've got a trunk of a car, a wheel of a car, would it apply to setting a tire on fire, for example?
Senator French, I would recommend talking to Lieutenant Dial, but when a motor vehicle described in statute is one that's registered by the Division of Motor Vehicles, so I would imagine it would be the whole car.
Senator Wilkowski and Senator Terrio.
Just on that point, I guess I would disagree with that interpretation. The way I read the statute, if a person intentionally damages, so I guess if you damage any part of the car by my reading of the statute, but perhaps we can get legal to answer that. But just on another topic, I've seen cars and trucks that have been hit with tire irons and baseball bats and shotgun blasts. And is there a reason we want to limit this just to starting fires?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, we chose the fire or the explosion because it creates that much more. If you hit a car, the damage is only to a car. You start a fire, you create a hazard to the public, to first responders who go out and take care of these. And just the damage to the habitat, it just expounds itself more than just to the vehicle.
Thank you.
Senator Terrio.
Well, if we have Trooper Dial on to testify, I guess I'd like to know the definition of a motor vehicle. Does it have to have, two axles and tires, and is capable of self propulsion. But Senator French, when you started your questioning, I wasn't sure if you were trying to differentiate between just a part of a car or a BMW versus a junker. You know,
I have some concern about making it a felony crime to say damage an already junked car. Right? I mean, you could build a campfire next to a junker car, and a few kids could suddenly find themselves facing felony charges. For hurting a junk car with a campfire, and so it just strikes me that we may want to think about making certain that there's a certain level of damage done to the car, because the bill says damages without any limitation on how significant or insignificant that damage may be.
So, you want to make sure that it's not the bonfire that the roasting marshmallows over. That it's they set the car on fire.
Right. I mean, I've seen an example where the car was like burned to a crisp, and that was like the exactly what this bill is aimed at. But you can just you're always your mind sort of wanders to more insignificant incidents that could provoke a felony charge, which is a very serious charge to face.
Yeah. And then I have a follow-up question. It is kind of strange here that if I torch my neighbor's house, that's arson. If I torch my own house, that's arson. And the differentiation here is I've torched my car or somebody else's car on public property. But I guess I could torch my own car in my driveway and I'd be okay, huh? It is kind of strange.
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, when we were doing this, we were addressing a concern that was just prevalent in our area, and it was state and municipal land. If feel necessary to, that needs to be addressed for private property, we can definitely look at that.
Yeah. Well, I understand the problem that you're trying to get at, and I'm sympathetic to that, but just want to make sure that we're getting at it the right way. Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. If you burn someone's car, isn't this already a Class C felony if you do this? If you burn someone's car, it's destruction of property worth more than $500. I would think it's already a Class C felony, isn't it?
I'd refer to Lieutenant Dial. I'm not sure about the specifics, and I wouldn't want to overstretch my boundaries.
We'll ask Lieutenant Dial about that. Senator McGuire, we are on HB 268.
Oh, good.
Anything else from you, Mr. Mulligan?
One note is that, and I don't know if it will ease your minds any, that you have to prove intent, because we say you're intentionally burning the vehicle. So if it is a campfire and it does get out of control, I believe that you wouldn't prosecute someone who is out having a bonfire who this accidentally happens to in some way. But I'd refer to the state fire marshal, David Taylor, I believe is online, and Lieutenant Dial.
Good answer. You should think about law school.
Yeah.
We do have folks sign up to testify. And let's go to them now. Let's start with Mr. David Tyler, who is, Hope, on the line.
Hi, yes, this is David Tyler. Can you hear me?
Yes, we sure can. Go ahead and state your name and affiliation and give us your testimony.
Hey, my name is David Tyler. I'm the state fire marshal. And first, I'd like just to thank Representative Stoltz for bringing this legislation forward. I think it's a good way of helping us control a problem that is out there. Because burning these vehicles, abandoned or derelict vehicles, is hazardous. And that's, I think, what the bottom line is. The first issue I'd like to address is the firefighter safety. We all know what the firefighters do is dangerous. And not much thought is normally given to the hazards of a vehicle fire because of the size of the infernos that we normally see when they're fighting their structure fires. But the vehicle fire hazards include like the shock absorber bumpers in the front. They explode like grenades, and they cause serious leg injuries. There's a number of things that can go wrong with those. Fuel tanks fail, and generally what happens there is the burning fuel spills out, but on some occasions the stuff can explode. And it's an unnecessary hazard that is being created for the firefighters that are responding. There's also the other hazard that's created is to the wildland. We've had a number of wildland fires that have been started by abandoned vehicles that were intentionally set on fire. None of them have gotten to be the serious large fires, but I think it's just more of a matter of time. And I can also speak to the area where the fires are occurring. If you're spending about 25 years in the interior, you know, we find them up and down Chino Hot Springs Road, the Steese Highway, down the dike, down the Tana River. There's a lot of vehicles that are abandoned there. And not all of them are able to, you know, be driven out. Sometimes they just tow them out there and torch them just to get rid of them. So that's part of our concern. And that concludes my testimony. If anybody has any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tyler. My first question is, can you give us a rough idea of how often cars are getting torched on public lands in our state?
I don't have the numbers for the state, but I could say in the interior, you're probably looking at 20, 30 times a year that you find area departments responding to these.
And in your experience, are these typically, you know, nice cars that are stolen and torched for fun, or are they old beaters that are torched for a different kind of fun?
These are generally the older ones that are just abandoned. People walk by and light them off, or sometimes they're torched off to conceal a crime. But generally, they're not the newer vehicles.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Tyler while we have him on the line? I don't hear or see any, sir. Thanks so much for making yourself available.
Thank you.
Next, let's turn to Britt Lively. Mr. Lively, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Oh, Britt, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I've been guessing people's, wrong on this already once today, but I beg your pardon. Please put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you. I am Britt Lively. First, the greeting, Honorable Chairman French and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I am Britt Lively, longtime resident of Butte, former member of the Community Council, co-founder of Butte Area Resident Civic Organization. We're asking for your support of HB 268. I have a prepared speech, but just in case I forget your questions that you had brought up previously about the kind of vehicles that get burned, whether one should make an exception for partial cars or incidental from burnings from campfires. We have seen them haul in junkers, either by a rope filled with explosives just to make a nice explosion. We have seen them or heard from the fire department that they haul in junkers, whether they tow them or put them on trucks, where they add propane bottles in the trunks or on the inside and extra tanks inside. So in our opinion, any kind of car. We have seen new cars burned, for instance, U-Haul cars that were stolen in Anchorage and brought out here. We have seen just recently a murder had been covered up and the car had been burned. The body was discovered a year later from a drug-related murder near to our neighborhood. And we have seen a van load full of tires that was stolen, wedged into the woods, and torched also very close to where we live. That was stolen. So now I hope I have answered some of these concerns of ours. And I will now do my prepared testimony. Thank you for hearing HB 268, which we ask you to support. We thank Representative Stoltz for having introduced this legislation at our request to make the burning of all motor vehicles, whether they're stolen, new, abandoned, or whether they are burned with the owner's permission on state and municipal lands, a Class C felony. And we want to thank all of Representative Stoltz's co-sponsors that joined along the way. You may think that a Class C felony might be a bit over the top for such childish behavior as burning a car. But imagine if 5 cars were burned in 1 weekend alone in the woods not far from your home, as happened here in Butte last year. in addition to the ongoing activity year-round, we're certain that you would be looking for an effective solution to keep your neighborhood safe. HB 268 is our solution. We have also, for your information, sent a map and description several years back of how many cars the Butte Fire Chief has identified as having been burned in our neighborhood. And I don't have those numbers at hand, but I could provide the committee with that. Believe me, the last thing we want to do is to contribute to an already overloaded court system. But we achieved consensus that HB 268 will enable state troopers to keep our homes and the forests surrounding us safe. Prior to asking our delegation to introduce such legislation, we consulted with troopers, emergency services, the local fire department, and members of our community, including a volunteer legal professional. The consensus was that currently Alaska State Troopers does not have the tools to deter car burners from endangering communities statewide. For over 25 years, we've been worried about car fires getting out of hand and getting to our homes. We've seen the burned-out hulks everywhere, along trails in the woods and along the road going to Butte School. One van that I just explained had the load of tires. So for over 25 years, we were told by borough and state officials that they don't have the resources nor the tools to fight this virtual epidemic of car burnings everywhere. Our initial efforts in the 90s led to the Mat-Su Borough and state troopers working out a way via VIN number ID to dispose of these burned-out hulks that had piled up on our public lands. This arrangement made it possible then, after we GPSed a huge accumulation of burned and shot vehicles, for the National Guard to go out and gather up all the wrecks in the Kinnick River Valley and Jim Creek area, and for dedicated volunteers, such as Mr. Barber, to get rid of these monstrosities. These activities have been accelerating, endangering local firefighters, contaminating our woods and waterways, placing our homes and lives in danger, and, not in the least, condemning our great community and beautiful area to a reputation that belittles and contradicts the values and standards which residents in normal communities can rightfully and peacefully enjoy. In our opinion, HB 268, making car burnings a Class C felony crime, will not jam up the legal system, but will serve as a powerful deterrent for misfits, including gang members and car thieves, who currently seem to enjoy their dangerous and destructive pursuits. Most of all, it will reassure watchful residents and users of public lands, knowing that when they report their observation of these dastardly deeds to the authorities, that they will find an open ear among the law enforcement community that will now have the tools to arrest these offenders so that the court system can impose the penalties to the fullest extent of a Class C felony crime, including the costs associated with towing, disposing of the vehicle, and mitigating any environmental impact. HB 268 is an easy fix to convict, but it is even a more easy fix to deter. Thank you very much, and I'll stay on the line for any questions you may have.
Ms. Lively, thank you so much. I don't see any questions for you right now. Last up is Marty Quas.
Hello.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd put yourself on the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Marty Quas. I am a resident of Alaska, a resident of the Mat-Su Borough, and a citizen of Alaska. And I would like to strongly support House Bill 268. I live on the south side of Kinnick River. I have basically a panoramic view from public use area from Jim Creek up to Friday Creek and even Wolf Point. Over the past years, on many occasions, I have contacted 911 reporting fires out on the river, car burnings, And the response that I get from the sergeant is basically, we don't have a vehicle to get out there. We can't do anything about it. And I think it is time that, something be done, because one of these days, one of these cars is going to start the woods on fire. We're going to have a wind coming down the Kinnick River, and it's going to blow it into the Butte area, and we're going to have a major calamity on our hands. Yes, I would like to strongly support this House Bill 268, and I thank you.
Sir, thank you for your good and concise remarks. I'll just say that we could make this a Class A felony, and I'm not sure that it's going to do anything about the manpower shortages that the troopers and the police departments face statewide. I just wanted to put that on the record, I appreciate your comments. And let me just turn now and ask Lieutenant Dial one question, if you're on the line, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am on the line.
I haven't pulled out the statute books to look, but probably during the committee you've had an opportunity to look into this, but why is this not felony criminal mischief?
For the record, my name is Lieutenant Rodney Dial. I'm stationed in Ketchikan. And, Mr. Chairman, right now if a person damages their own vehicle, they're allowed to do that. It becomes criminal mischief when they damage the property of another. And in those cases, we can not only charge criminal mischief, but sometimes criminally negligent burning. However, when a person damages a vehicle that belongs to themselves on state or public land, in many cases, there's not a lot we can do about it. And that's one of the reasons we support House Bill 268, because it will allow us to actually take some action, some enforcement action, and hopefully stop that. And I would just like to add that a Class E penalty, a Class E felony, basically allows the court to assess a wide range of sentencing options, from no time at all and a suspended imposition of sentence up to a couple years if, in the worst-case scenario, a car fire were to start a Miller Street-style wildfire and create a significant amount of damage. So we certainly support it, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
I suspected that you would have a good answer. You did. And I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. It is close to our time to retire, so what we'll do is set this bill aside and adjourn for the day. Thanks so much.
Thank you.